Yale Podcast Network.
Hello, and welcome to the Yale Law Journal podcast. I'm Cody Poplin.
And I'm Sasha Dudding,
the show's co-host. On this podcast, we'll be interviewing Yale Law Journal authors about their forthcoming and recently published work. We hope you'll subscribe and follow along as we dive deeper into contemporary legal scholarship. We're very excited to bring you our first episode of Volume 128, which features Professor David Posen's new article, Transparency's Ideological Drift. Professor Posen is a professor of law at Columbia Law School. He teaches and writes about constitutional law, national security law, information law, and other topics. Professor Posen, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
So first, Professor Posen, your article is titled Transparency's Ideological Drift. What inspired you to write this article? Why write about transparency now?
Well, the origins of my own projects are always a little bit murky, even to me. But I think the immediate genesis was the Freedom of Information Act, one of our landmark transparency laws, turned 50 in 2016. And I helped run a big conference at Columbia on its 50th anniversary. And that led me to look more closely than I had before at how FOIA was actually operating on its 50th anniversary. And I found a lot of dispiriting things, some of which are pretty well documented in the literature, including very heavy corporate use of FOIA in contravention of the expectations of its drafters that it would be a tool primarily for public interested journalists and researchers, a sense in which FOIA was posing a big obstacle to the work of certain agencies which had found it weaponized against them. We might single out the Environmental Protection Agency here, while on the other hand, not really penetrating deeply at all into the national security state and those areas where transparency might be most valuable. And so I ended up finding on various dimensions that FOIA had drifted away from its progressive aspirations of those who created it, and wrote an article about that. And this article that we're talking about today broadens and kind of generalizes the argument in that FOIA-specific piece, because as I kept digging into the evolution of transparency law, I found that across numerous statutory domains, there was a comparable story happening of transparency in its uses and effects and popular understandings in some cases, having a kind of left-to-right movement.
Great. So you mentioned some of that left-to-right movement, what you've called ideological drift. We want to unpack some of those core components. But first, I'm wondering if we could start a little bit by talking about the concept of ideological drift. So what does that term mean?
So the term is Jack Balkin's, and he, when he was J.M. Balkin, provoking all over the place in his brilliant early writing, had a few pieces where he developed this concept, and he says that it's a pervasive feature of our kind of public law practice in the United States, that certain concepts, at the time they're introduced into a legal or policy debate, have a certain identifiable ideological or political valence. You know, they are liberal ideas, or they're conservative ideas, or they're populist or elitist ideas, and they're also thought to have a certain set of more or less determinant effects. You know, they will empower this group in society or that group. As the world changes, however, around these ideas or these terms, and in some cases as the terms themselves are appropriated for new uses or reinterpreted by future actors, we sometimes see, or we often see, concepts take on a very different political meaning in future periods. So the example that Balkin relies on most heavily in his early work, and is a particularly kind of pure example of drift, and that's of the colorblind constitution. And he notes that when first introduced by the first Justice Harlan in his dissent in Plessy versus Ferguson in 1896, the idea of a colorblind constitution was a radically progressive idea. It would have represented a major advance for the constitutional position of racial minorities in this country if the courts were to have adopted it. Of course, it loses in that case. But over time, the colorblind conceit drifts from left to right, and de jure segregation is of course outlawed. And now, when we find constitutional interpreters and advocates invoking the idea of a colorblind constitution, it's almost entirely from a conservative perspective, as an argument against race-conscious measures that are meant to reduce racial hierarchy and increase racial integration. And so it's a particularly kind of clear example of drift, although Balkin at points suggests that it's a more or less ubiquitous feature of constitutional practice that ideas exhibit this instability.
One question I have, maybe just following up on that, is obviously here in your article regarding transparency and then the example you just pointed out by Professor Balkin on colorblindness, we see two examples of progressive ideas drifting rightward and becoming more conservative. I'm wondering if there are examples of that happening in the opposite direction as well, ideas that have gone from right to left maybe.
There must be, although much of the literature that invokes Balkin's concept seems to have the left-right directionality that you note, and indeed at one point in one of his follow-on pieces, Balkin suggested that we most often see drift from left to right. He didn't actually kind of pause to explain that. That could just be a feature of American, you know, society drifting rightward, you know, at least arguably in the last several decades. And conceptually, however, I don't think there's any reason to expect that an idea couldn't have the opposite directionality in its drift. I don't know. Here's one candidate that just comes to mind. I'm sure there are better ones. The idea of the individual mandate for purchasing health insurance, you know, was initially hatched by the Heritage Foundation and had distinguished from more aggressive government responses to problems in the health insurance market, like single payer, was a conservative idea. Romney, of course, tries it out in Massachusetts as governor. By the time that the Affordable Care Act adopts the individual mandate, it starts to get thoroughly demonized as a socialistic left idea. So, you know, in the kind of political and popular rhetoric and understanding of the individual mandate, we see a pretty sharp movement from right to left, at least at the level of kind of cultural understandings, whatever you actually think of the mandate. So maybe that's one example. I do think that in principle, drift should be able to work both ways.
Great.
And just one more sort of definitional question before we move into the meat of your article. I was wondering if you could just sort of define the term transparency for us. What exactly does it mean as you use it?
Great. There's a whole literature, kind of a sub-literature just on that definitional question, which I try not to get bogged down by in the piece. I'm mainly thinking about transparency as an administrative law concept. So that is the proposition that institutions, and as a governance concept, that institutions should be made open to observation by outsiders, whether the general public or auditors or inspectors not housed within the institution. And in being made more open and observable in that way, you know, subject to new forms of oversight and discipline. So a kind of standard definition of transparency as a legal and administrative norm that an institution is going to be open in new ways to outside monitoring. I don't mean to talk about transparency in people's individual lives. You know, I kind of just bracket for purposes of the paper transparency about ourselves as individuals, which raises separate issues of privacy, exhibitionism, exposure that are not part of my administrative law story.
Great. And that, just to be clear, covers sort of open meetings, open records, and data alike?
Yes, great. So there are different axes on which any given institution can be transparent, even by that kind of generic administrative law definition. In its deliberations, in the records it produces, in the outputs it produces, in the data it relies on, all those are potentially embraced by my story. So the way U.S. transparency law tends to carve up the statutory landscape, you know, open records laws like the Freedom of Information Act and its state-level analogs, you got open meetings laws like Government of the Sunshine Act, Federal Advisory Committee Act, you have open data policies increasingly being passed, and you have disclosure mandates that agencies themselves often create and enforce, imposed on private institutions like regulated firms. I bring in as well.
Professor Posen, Your piece, one of the major contributions, as I read it, is tracing this historical arc of the idea of transparency from the progressive era to the present. I'm wondering if you can maybe walk us through how transparency has drifted over time, beginning with its foundations in the progressive era as a tool for regulatory reform, and exactly what transparency was envisioned as a tool and what it could be accomplished or what could be accomplished with it.
Okay, great. There are many steps in that story. So maybe helpful to start with where transparency started. The proposition that it was understood as a progressive value aspiration before we get to the what happens over time to it. So the basic history I tell is of focuses on two periods when transparency law was most salient and kind of the canonical periods of transparency law formation in this country, the progressive era and then the 1960s and 70s. And in both periods, I suggest the advocates and reformers and policymakers who were designing the major transparency laws self-consciously and explicitly understood themselves to be engaged in a progressive project, progressive in the sense of empowering the government to solve social problems, curbing the influence of big business on government, producing more democratically accountable regulation and legislation, and leveling the playing field between ordinary people and powerful special interests that might, in a non-transparent political process, tend to prevail over them. So in the progressive era itself, in the early 1900s, publicity, that was the term they used, was a significant and explicit centerpiece of a political program to make government stronger, more effective at regulating the economy, fairer to ordinary people. And it was understood not as an end in itself, but rather as a necessary precondition for facilitating new modes of regulation and democratic action. And so the progressive placed tremendous faith in publicity as a tool for more energetic and democratically accountable regulation. But they didn't kind of fetishize it for its own sake. So I try to recover the thinking around publicity in that period, and then I jump the story forward to the 1960s and 70s, where we get a lot of the landmark transparency laws that are still with us today, from FOIA to FACA to GITSA to the opening up of Congress through laws like the Legislative Reorganization Act of 1970, and in that period I suggest that in some ways. The transparency movement had already evolved, was already somewhat more skeptical of government agencies than, say, in the capital P progressive era. But still, a constant refrain in the legislative history of all those laws was that if we just increase the transparency around records, meetings, and the like, we will restore public faith in government, we'll make government more trusted, we'll also make it more effective, we'll get better decisions. And we'll get, in the kind of argo of the time, we'll get more public-interested decisions. We will reduce the interest of the, reduce the influence of the special interest actor who, has heretofore had privileged access in back rooms to policymakers, and will align agencies and lawmakers and centers better with the general public, and kind of level the playing field in that way. So that strand of progressive thinking about what transparency is good for is very much picked up on again in the 1960s and 70s, and is a dominant feature of the justifications that are given for the laws at that time.
If I can really quickly, you noted how publicity was there's this concept of publicity in the progressive era, and that it seems to change a little bit when you get to the 1960s and 70s, and there's a focus more on a right to know. You tell us a little bit about how those are conceptually distinct and the way that those distinctions ended up shaping the types of regulations that come out of the two eras?
Yeah, there's so great. In some sense, I want to suggest that they're continuous, the transparency story in the early 20th century and then in the 60s and 70s, in just those aspects that I was talking about a moment ago, in the desire to make the political process more egalitarian, effective, trusted, redistributive, and so on. But as you say, the rhetoric has shifted, interestingly, from publicity to right to know, and with it, some substantive ideas have arguably changed as well. You know, for one thing, the right to know sounds a more individualistic note. It's now, transparency is now conceptualized as a right that individual citizens have as citizens. You know, with that, there's an idea of new forms of enforceability of transparency mandates. So you get judicial supervision of some of these laws. You can, most importantly, probably through FOIA, get judicial review of agency denials of records you feel have been wrongly withheld from you. So it's also a more legalistic notion. And at the same time, you know, the right to know sounds a kind of bold, emancipatory note. There's still this notion that with information, meaningful social change is going to follow. But there is behind the right to know formulation as compared to publicity, I do think it's fair to say there's more skepticism about government already creeping in, and there's more complacency about economic structure and consumerism. You know, Ralph Nader is a kind of emblematic figure here. He's leading the charge for a lot of these open government reforms in the late 60s and early 70s as part of a consumer protection, you know, program. And so he's kind of accused by some on the left of being complicit in capitalism's ills, while he's attacked on the right for being overbearing and leading to heavy-handed regulation of business. And he kind of embodies in one person some of the tensions were starting to arise in the transparency movement at that time. But at the same time, Nader doesn't think that what he's doing might pave the way for anti-progressive developments in the future. He is, at the same time that he's crusading for transparency, seeking new environmental protections, securities law regulation, worker protections. He very much thinks that the transparency movement is kind of symbiotic with those other progressive fronts on which, you know, progressive efforts he's engaged in. And part of my story is how the transparency piece comes apart over the years that follow.
And could you just sort of walk us through those years? So from the 60s and 70s to the current day, how did transparency change and what does it look like now?
Great. Okay. So it depends to some extent on what area of transparency law one is looking at. And I could talk through the different areas and then we can think about common threads. But in the open records context, I already hinted at some of the developments. There's the predominance of commercial requesters at many agencies, and therefore a kind of corporate capture that's occurred, arguably, under FOIA. Not at all agencies, but at many significant regulatory agencies, including the SEC and the FDA, more than two-thirds of the requests filed under FOIA are by commercial requesters, and they've come to crowd out more public-interested requesters, and they're getting a kind of informational subsidy from the government, which recoups on some accounts less than 1% of the costs it incurs of fulfilling FOIA requests. At the same time, as I also mentioned before, FOIA has failed miserably in its effort, especially as amended in 1974, to get at overclassification on the national security side. Judges quickly proved that they weren't very interested in reviewing Exemption 1, that's the national security exemption claims, with any vigor. Exemption 3 carves out almost all the work of the intelligence agencies. Exemption 7 for law enforcement agencies has been read very broadly by courts. So you have, on the one hand, FOIA helping commercial requesters in particular. On the other hand, it failing to open up the national security state. And in addition, you have the rise of certain aggressively anti-regulatory groups like Judicial Watch that have kind of learned how to weaponize FOIA to go after particular disfavored officials. Okay, so this is a story. FOIA is complicated. It also throws off a number of benefits. In some ways, I think it's the most complicated case, but at least on some dimensions, FOIA has disserved its progressive goals. There's also not any evidence that it has increased trust in government, I might add. And to the contrary, in this other FOIA piece I wrote before this one we're talking about now, I talk about how in some ways FOIA is a machine built to fail and generates a kind of steady drumbeat of a journalism of disenchantment, I think I called it, about with these journalists who are constantly frustrated by unrealistic deadlines not being met and kind of socialized into a culture of dysfunction and lawlessness through their experience of FOIA. FOIA, in other words, performs the very government dysfunction that it is then enlisted to expose. Open meetings laws. The basic story there is one of a parallel to the FOIA story. In theory, it sounded great. Throw open meetings to everyone, and we'll see how the sausage is made. In practice, business lobbyists are often the groups who are most likely to attend meetings in any systematic fashion and then hold people to account for what they say there. At the same time, open meetings have some evidence suggest shifted actual deliberation into back channels and kind of ironically or perversely given people actually less insight into how decisions are actually getting made, while at the same time empowering business lobbyists in particular, who are the ones who actually frequent the meetings with any regularity and are no longer, you know, kind of kept in the hallways when issues are getting discussed. This could get tedious if I go on every issue, but I guess I'll try to be quicker. But I'll just say in Congress, there's again a similar story of opening up Congress, arguably empowering business lobbyists above any other group. And also, as Congress gets more and more partisan since the late 1970s, having to do business in the glare of publicity, just making it harder for people to negotiate in good faith around multidimensional solutions to complex policy problems and cut deals. You know, people get locked into their kind of partisan persona, at least a good amount of evidence suggests, when in a political body like Congress. And there are many, many factors, I think, contributing to problems in Congress, but the opening up of it doesn't seem to have helped in the way that it was hoped for. Should I go on? I mean, other areas or down the line? Or
I mean, that's been a very helpful overview. If there's any other examples that come to mind, I mean, you mentioned the Federalist Society's sort of 2016 Regulatory Transparency Project as a key example.
Yeah, I don't know if that's a key example or just kind of a, I don't know, good a little slogan or something that captures a lot of these complex dynamics. And that is that when launching this regulatory transparency project in 2016, the Federal Society, obviously a conservative legal group, says the reason it's doing it is to foster a national conversation around the issue of regulatory excess and the harms it causes. And that kind of conflation or that equivalence that's drawn between transparency and exposure of regulatory excess is just an inversion of the progressive notion that more transparency would actually make the regulatory state more powerful because it would make it more trusted and more aware of the problems that needed solving and more participatory. And so you just see in that FedSoc line kind of the whole story of Drift encapsulated. I'll just note without getting into it that there's also movement, I think, from left to right in the consumer transparency movement and the way in which it came to substitute for more robust regulatory approaches to get at problems like predatory lending, say, or executive compensation or any number of problems where there's a worry that consumers are being exploited or that practices of firms are otherwise undermining public values, the turn toward disclosure in lieu of more robust regulatory approaches has been a big and notable trend there. And in campaign finance regulation, transparency has been invoked to justify, legitimate the dismantling of spending regulations over several decades now. Slightly different story, but part of the same package. The open data movement I also talk about has a very often makes very bold claims about the power of transparency, while at the same time taking a very thinned out and skeptical view of what government can accomplish. There's a kind of, I say at one point, a nearly theological faith in technology and private ordering that movement reflects. And okay, so I know I'm going on at too much length, but I think there's a complex story across numerous interacting domains. And you have to kind of see them all, you know, panoptically to understand that there's a major movement happening here across American regulatory practice, in which transparency is moving in the same direction on multiple fronts. One of the hopes of the paper is that seeing that all put together can be illuminating.
So you laid out a couple of different areas in regulatory reforms where perhaps the goal of transparency has been confounded by this rightward drift. I'm curious if you can talk a little bit about what have been the key drivers of these changes over time. You note both, I think, external and internal drivers, and I'm wondering if you could lay out a couple of those.
Great. Okay, so internal to transparency law, I think certain features of our leading transparency laws conduce to this kind of drift in ways that may not have been appreciated when they were created. So for one thing, I've tried to there are at least two big asymmetries that characterize these laws that I've tried to highlight in the paper. So one is the treatment of national security agencies versus non-national security agencies. And the laws penetrate just far less deeply into the former, into the national security agencies, partly as a function of judicial interpretation, but also to a large extent by their design. Insofar as some of the initial progressive impetus to pass these laws was driven by concern about secrecy around things like the Vietnam War, overclassification of national security documents, that goal has not been realized. While the laws have become ever more powerful, arguably steroidal, you know, when it comes to bread and butter regulatory and enforcement agencies of domestic policy, like the National Labor Relations Board or the Environmental Protection Agency. Okay, so the design of the laws asymmetrically skews the distribution of scrutiny, journalistic scrutiny, NGO scrutiny, looking for government acts that need exposure, need discipline, need response toward non-national security parts of the administrative state with some I think, significant effects on public law and legal culture. The other big asymmetry is the treatment of the private sector versus the public sector. Another important feature of our leading transparency laws is that they target government bodies and only government bodies. And so on the one hand, private firms can utilize these laws for advantage or gaining a kind of leverage sometimes over their overseers. You see that in the FOIA context in particular, also the Data Access Act, Data Quality Act. And at the same time, they themselves are exempt, right, from being exposed through these laws. So I like this work by a professor in Mexico named Irma Sandoval Ballesteros, where she refers to the anti-public sector bias, she calls it. She's actually talking about anti-corruption law, but we can apply her insights to transparency law as well. And so there's this nice piece by a journalist whose name escapes me in a magazine called Pando, in which he reflects or asks the question, you know, the classic muckraking journalists of the early 20th century were often as interested or more interested in exposing corruption in big business as they were in government. But it seems that all of our journalists today are focused for the most part on exposing misdeeds in government. In other words, investigative reporting has become very focused on government and much less so on the private sector. Why is that, he asks. And one thing he doesn't bring into the analysis, which I think a lawyer can add, is that's partly, I think, an artifact of the structure of transparency law. FOIA gives journalists a tool, but it's only good for going after, you know, federal agencies and not after private companies. And same with open meetings laws. And so I think transparency law has, kind of riveted critical attention on a certain set of actors, namely the non-national security government agencies and private corporations, national security agencies get a pass relative to them. And that has significant effects on our politics. Outside of the law, you know, they're just broad social trends happening. This is kind of, you know, like Balkin talks about in his original piece, the world changes and the meaning of an idea or a policy changes. So a lot is happening in the world since the 70s, which probably bears on this story. But, you know, for one thing, there's the rise of a whole architecture of conservative news organizations, think tanks, legal groups, watchdog groups that are create, you know, kind of new users of transparency laws and new intermediaries who are interpreting what government disclosures mean with a different perspective. Trust in government is declining generally. I don't think it could fairly be argued that transparency is like the main or the dominant factor. There's a lot of factors contributing to that. Although here I do think it's fair to ask whether the designers of the canonical transparency laws may have got things exactly backward in their understanding of the relationship of transparency reform to public trust. They thought that if you just open up these bodies to some extent, people will take comfort from that and trust would be restored. There's a lot of theoretical and some experimental evidence now to suggest that people never feel actually sufficiently empowered by a transparency measure to the point where they now trust the institution that's been opened up. Instead, the institution ends up getting held to an unrealistic standard. A kind of adversarial dynamic is created between the watchers and the watched. Nora O'Neill calls this a culture of suspicion that's created. And there's no kind of happy equilibrium that's ever reached where people just feel satisfied with the amount that they know about an agency. Instead, they just demand ever more transparency. So,
you draw on Justice Brandeis's comment, the sunlight is the best disinfectant. But I thought one of the most powerful lines in the piece is that too much sunlight can turn any ecosystem into Death Valley.
I meant that a little less as a point about the dynamics of trust as they relate to transparency, although it's related, but a little more on some of the evidence we have that past some functional threshold, transparency starts to deliver less and less marginal benefit, right, in terms of the efficacy of the organization or the degree to which abuse is actually revealed or the degree to which people actually feel empowered on the outside and can become pathological in incapacitating of good action by the organization. That metaphor came to me that some amount of transparency, some amount of sunlight, you know, probably is healthy for any ecosystem, just like for any public institution. But we wouldn't want to live right in the constant glare of publicity in Death Valley.
Right.
Also, maybe this would be helpful to bring in something I don't think is in the paper, but I'll just note that Fred Schauer has a nice argument that comes to mind here. And in a piece called Transparency in Three Dimensions, he talked about how you can think about the distribution of government actions on a kind of a normal distribution, a bell curve, with really, really terrible decisions on one side and really, really great, bold, innovative moves on the other, in a big fat middle. And Schauer kind of noted that formal transparency requirements lop off both sides of the distribution. You don't get some really horrible things happening that sunlight might actually expose or deter. But you also don't get agencies doing a lot of things you might want them to do on the other side of the distribution because of the way in which they may be chilled from doing that or scared off. Certain interest groups may be in the room now. They're kind of pushed toward the middle. And Schauer's point is that you might feel very differently about that effect of transparency to disable both sorts of decisions, depending on what side of an environment you're in. So he says, if you're in a really, really corrupt society with a known, really corrupt leader, you might be happy to make that trade-off because you're just really worried about terrible things happening and not so concerned about stopping really good things from happening. But in an environment like arguably characterizes a lot of the U.S. administrative state now, where we have really robust checks, really robust accountability mechanisms, on a lot of these agencies, some of which are kind of world historically open public bodies and subject to inspector general oversight and congressional oversight and GAO auditing and KTAM actions. You know, we could, like, a lot of accountability mechanisms have proliferated over the last several decades. You might actually start to feel less good, or at least a little more ambivalent about that trade-off. So just another more, I don't know, another way to get at the Death Valley point with maybe a little more rigor.
Yeah.
And lastly, I'll just say there are other things happening in the world too, of course, that may be affecting the meaning of transparency over the last several decades. The sense in which there's been a neoliberal turn in administrative thinking more broadly, you know, I kind of mentioned the paper in technological change as well. There's a big messy story of how a lot of factors are overlapping to drive transparency to the right. But I do want to emphasize that some of the factors, at least, are a product of the law's design. So you can't just say, but society moved to the right, and so transparency moved to the right, and it's that simple, and therefore there's kind of nothing for the transparency reformer to do necessarily, because all of this is being driven by extrinsic factors. I do think there's an interaction over time between the design of transparency laws and the broader political environment that I try to underscore.
So I wanted to ask you about that point in specific. If we understand transparency as largely a regulatory technique, what other principles or aims need to be in place for it to be effective?
Great. So I'm never. I don't think prescription is ever been my strong suit. But at the end of the article, I guess I try to suggest some principles that might guide thinking here, stated pretty generally. So one really important one is that transparency should not be seen as a standalone solution for almost any policy problem. In area after area after area, and I try to catalog quite a few in the article, a transparency fix alone to get at some problem of economic predation or the vulnerability of a certain group in society or whatever else it is, has proven insufficient. We just have abundant evidence now that, except with very few exceptions, just increasing transparency in itself rarely leads to meaningful progressive social change. And so I say that maybe the most important conceptual move or design move to make is to think of transparency as a complement to, not a substitute for, other forms of regulation. Transparency may be an indispensable complement to good regulation in a lot of areas, but it should be seen as just one tool among others that need to be enlisted in concert to solve almost any problem. I'm happy to expand on that, but I think that may be the most important thing I feel like I have to say in the end of the paper. I also talk about how we should kind of desacralize, deromanticize transparency, treat it more like an ordinary administrative norm, not like the kind of thing that you just want to maximize for its own sake, which I basically view as a kind of mystical thinking in many contexts. We should recognize its distributive effects and kind of politicize transparency to that extent, not make it partisan, but be conscious of the political and distributive work it's doing. And we should seek transparency most aggressively where the lack of it is connected to asymmetries in power. Mm. It's another classic progressive insight that, you know, we should be most concerned about secrecy where it enables arbitrary domination to occur. I don't think that's plausibly a story anymore about most U.S. regulatory agencies. Again, these are extremely open and accountable entities on a lot of metrics. Marginally more transparency from them is in most cases only going to have a very, very limited value, may have real costs. In contrast, certain parts of the private sector, certain national security agencies, intelligence agencies, maybe increasingly algorithms in both the public and private sector, these seem to me like the right candidates, you know, for transparency reform. So I also suggest a kind of refocusing of transparency activism toward those places where asymmetries of information are connected with asymmetries of power. And that may seem like a very banal thing to say. It is, in some sense, but it really doesn't reflect the distribution of where transparency law does the most work right now.
Right, right. I guess maybe just one last question is, where do you see this going in the future? I don't know how much you want to step out and prognosticate, but what do you think future dynamics are going to look like in the next couple of years or decades?
I don't know. the future is, you know, is never transparent.
Sure.
I guess a few thoughts. One is I say this in the conclusion of the article, but I guess I feel like the rise of Trumpism has complicated some of my story and the relationship of a lot of the groups that might be interested in these issues to the reforms they're seeking. And by that, I mean, I guess there's such a strongly felt imperative by so many liberals and those on the left that to resist Trumpism, which is itself such a menace to so many liberal and progressive values, that there's this kind of all hands on deck mentality, you know, pick up a tool wherever you can find it. The immediate imperative is resistance. Mm-hmm. And so this has kind of led to a renewed interest in some tools like FOIA for some. And I don't deny that there's something very appealing about that short-term move. Sometimes you just need something to fight with. But I do worry that these dynamics are be kind of obscuring the anti-progressive work that some of these same tools have been doing for quite a few years now. And so there's this kind of haloing of transparency that's happening in the resistance effort. That I think I worry will come back to bite progressive movements who want to build a more active and egalitarian and effective democratic state in the future. And there's a sense in which transparency is itself asymmetric there, insofar as it's most effective, at least in its current formulations in law, at attacking, you know, trying to expose government actors, and insofar as progressives have just a general baseline commitment to wanting to invigorate government, make it work better, as against libertarians or conservatives, they kind of stand more to lose from an environment in which transparency is weaponized by both sides. Okay, so I have this ambivalence around what the way in which, and this concern about the way in which transparency is being talked about in some quarters today. And I also just want to emphasize that this point about recognizing the limits of transparency, I think, is really important too for those in the resistance. You know, you get Trump's tax returns, major transparency win, and then what? You know, there. I strongly suspect that there too, the transparency in itself would prove insufficient to drive any meaningful reform. Okay, so in a narrow political sense, that's one answer to your question about where this might go. In a very different sense, you know, about where the article might go or the scholarly intervention might go, I really don't know, except that I've had some already exciting interdisciplinary responses to the piece since, I guess, I put a draft online. Perhaps most notably here, some art historians who are doing a special issue in a journal about transparency seem quite excited about the piece. And they tell me, at least, that there's a similar story of transparency's drift from left to right in architecture, and that they want to kind of build on the drift idea. And there, you know, they mention, I'm no expert in this at all, that authors like Walter Benjamin in the early 20th century said that to live in a glass house, I remember this quote, is a revolutionary virtue par excellence. And there was this idea that transparency in architecture would lead to a kind of rejection of, you know, bourgeois individualism and breed a more communal and authentic manner of living. And it was kind of wrapped up in socialistic and communist projects and utopian projects. And then over the course of the 20th century, transparency or glass in architecture gets thoroughly co-opted by corporations, by corporate architecture.
Right.
And now is associated with kind of, scary panoptic surveillance of workers and kind of corporate coldness and callousness, you know, and has a very different association in architecture. And so the idea, I guess, of these art historians is that there's a parallel story of drift, of transparency in architecture and art history that picks up on some of the themes I'm describing. So, you know, those kinds of I look forward to seeing a scholarship on that kind of takes the basic observations of the paper in new directions, even beyond law.
The article is Transparency's Ideological Drift. It's in issue 1 of volume 128 of the Yale Law Journal. Professor David Posen, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
The Yale Law Journal podcast is a production of the Yale Law Journal. Thanks to Ryan McAvoy and the wonderful folks at the Yale Broadcast Studio for making this production possible. If you like the show, don't forget to share it and give us a rating wherever you get your podcasts. And make sure to check back next month for episode 2, when we'll be talking to Professor Cynthia Eslin of NYU Law School about her forthcoming article.